We have purposely used the same water analogy for these drastic space-tearing transmutations and for the transmutations from one of the five formulations of string theory to another, chapter 12, because they are deeply connected. Recall that we express that the five string theories are dual to one another, and thereby are unified under the rubric of a single overarching theory. But does the ability to move continuously from one description to another, to set sail from any point on the M-theory map and reach any other, persist even after we allow the extra dimensions to curl up into some Calabi-Yau shape or another? Prior to the discovery of the drastic topology-changing results, the anticipated answer was no, since there was no known way to continuously deform one Calabi-Yau shape into any other. But now we see that the answer is yes. Through these physically sensible space-tearing conifold transitions, we can continuously change any given Calabi-Yau space into any other. By varying coupling constants and curled-up Calabi-Yau geometry, we see that all string constructions are, once again, different phases of a single theory. Even after curling up all extra dimensions, the unity of the M-theory map firmly holds. Black hole entropy. For many years, some of the most accomplished theoretical physicists speculated about the possibility of space-tearing processes and of a connection between black holes and elementary particles. Although such speculations might have sounded like science fiction at first, the discovery of string theory, with its ability to merge general relativity and quantum mechanics, has allowed us now to plant these possibilities firmly at the forefront of cutting-edge science. This success emboldens us to ask whether any of the other mysterious properties of our universe that have stubbornly resisted resolution for decades might also succumb to the powers of string theory. Foremost among these is the notion of black hole entropy. This is the arena in which string theory has most impressively flexed its muscles, successfully solving a quarter-century-old problem of profound significance. Entropy is a measure of disorder or randomness. For instance, if your desk is cluttered high with layer upon layer of open books, half-read articles, old newspapers, and junk mail, it is in a state of high disorder or high entropy. On the other hand, if it is fully organized with articles in alphabetized folders, newspapers neatly stacked in chronological order, books arranged in alphabetical order by author, and pens placed in their designated holders, your desk is in a state of high order, or equivalently, low entropy. This example illustrates the essential idea, but physicists have given a fully quantitative definition to entropy that allows one to describe something's entropy by using a definite numerical value. Larger numbers mean greater entropy, smaller numbers mean less entropy. Although the details are a little complicated, this number, roughly speaking, counts the possible rearrangements of the ingredients in a given physical system that leave its overall appearance intact. When your desk is neat and clean, almost any rearrangement, changing the order of the newspapers, books, or articles, moving the pens from their holders, will disturb its highly ordered organization. This accounts for its having low entropy. On the contrary, when your desk is a mess, numerous rearrangements of the newspapers, articles, and junk mail will leave it a mess and therefore will not disturb its overall appearance. This accounts for its having high entropy. Of course, the description of rearranging books, articles, and newspapers on a desktop and deciding which rearrangements leave its overall appearance intact lacks scientific precision. The rigorous definition of entropy actually involves counting or calculating the number of possible rearrangements of the microscopic quantum mechanical properties of the elementary constituents of a physical system that do not affect its gross macroscopic properties, such as its energy or pressure. The details are not essential so long as you realize that entropy is a fully quantitative quantum mechanical concept that precisely measures the overall disorder of a physical system. In 1970, Jacob Bekenstein, then a graduate student of John Wheeler's at Princeton, made an audacious suggestion. he put forward the remarkable idea that black holes might have entropy, and a huge amount of it. Bekenstein was motivated by the venerable and well-tested second law of thermodynamics, which declares that the entropy of a system always increases. Everything tends toward greater disorder. Even if you clean your cluttered desk, decreasing its entropy, the total entropy, including that of your body and the air in the room, actually increases. You see, to clean your desk, you have to expend energy. You have to disrupt some of the orderly molecules of fat in your body to create this energy for your muscles, and as you clean, your body gives off heat, which jostles the surrounding air molecules into a higher state of agitation and disorder. When all of these effects are accounted for, they more than compensate for your desk's decrease in entropy, and thus the total entropy increases. But what happens, Bekenstein in effect asked, if you clean your desk near the event horizon of a black hole and you set up a vacuum pump to suck all of the newly agitated air molecules from the room into the hidden depths of the black hole's interior? We can be even more extreme. What if the vacuum pumps all the air and all the contents on the desk and even the desk itself into the black hole, leaving you in a cold, airless, thoroughly ordered room? Since the entropy in your room has certainly decreased, Bekenstein reasoned that the only way to satisfy the second law of thermodynamics would be for the black hole to have entropy, and for this entropy to sufficiently increase as matter is pumped into it to offset the observed entropic decrease outside the black hole's exterior. In fact, Bekenstein was able to draw on a famous result of Stephen Hawking's to strengthen his case. Hawking had shown that the area of the event horizon of a black hole, recall this is the surface of no return that enshrouds every black hole, always increases in any physical interaction. Hawking demonstrated that if an asteroid falls into a black hole, or if some of the surface gas of a nearby star accretes onto the black hole, or if two black holes collide and combine, in any of these processes and all others as well, the total area of the event horizon of a black hole always increases. To Bekenstein, the inexorable evolution to greater total area suggested a link with the inexorable evolution to greater total entropy embodied in the second law of thermodynamics. He proposed that the area of the event horizon of a black hole provides a precise measure of its entropy. On closer inspection, though, there are two reasons why most physicists thought that Bekenstein's idea could not be right. First, black holes would seem to be among the most ordered and organized objects in the whole universe. Once one measures the black hole's mass, the force charges it carries, and its spin, its identity has been nailed down precisely. With so few defining features, a black hole appears to lack sufficient structure to allow for disorder. Just as there is little havoc one can wreak on a desktop that holds solely a book and a pencil, black holes seem too simple to support disorder. The second reason that Bekenstein's proposal was hard to swallow is that entropy, as we have discussed it here, is a quantum mechanical concept, whereas black holes, until recently, were firmly entrenched in the antagonistic camp of classical general relativity. In the early 1970s, without a way to merge general relativity and quantum mechanics, it seemed awkward, at best, to discuss the possible entropy of a black hole. How black is black? As it turns out, Hawking too had thought of the analogy between his black hole area increase law and the law of inevitable increase of entropy, but he dismissed it as nothing more than a coincidence. After all, Hawking argued, based upon his area increase law and other results he had found with James Bardeen and Brandon Carter, if one did take the analogy between the laws of black holes and the laws of thermodynamics seriously, not only would one be forced to identify the area of the black hole's event horizon with entropy, but it turns out that one would also have to assign a temperature to the black hole, with the precise value determined by the strength of the black hole's gravitational field at its event horizon. But if a black hole has a non-zero temperature, no matter how small, the most basic and well-established physical principles would require it to emit radiation, much like a glowing poker. But black holes, as everyone knows, are black. They supposedly do not emit anything. Hawking and most everyone else agreed that this definitively ruled out Bekenstein's suggestion. Instead, Hawking was willing to accept that if matter carrying entropy is dropped into a black hole, this entropy is lost, plain and simple. So much for the second law of thermodynamics. This was the case until Hawking, in 1974, discovered something truly amazing. Black holes, Hawking announced, are not completely black. If one ignores quantum mechanics and invokes only the laws of classical general relativity, then, as originally found some six decades previously, black holes certainly do not allow anything, not even light, to escape their gravitational grip. But the inclusion of quantum mechanics modifies this conclusion in a profound way. Even though he was not in possession of a quantum mechanical version of general relativity, Hawking was able to finesse a partial union of these two theoretical tools that yielded some limited yet reliable results. And the most important result he found was that black holes do emit radiation, quantum mechanically. The calculations are long and arduous, but Hawking's basic idea is simple. We have seen that the uncertainty principle ensures that even the vacuum of empty space is a teeming, roiling frenzy of virtual particles momentarily erupting into existence and subsequently annihilating one another. This jittery quantum behavior also occurs in the region of space just outside the event horizon of a black hole. Hawking realized, however, that the gravitational might of the black hole can inject energy into a pair of virtual photons, say, that tears them just far enough apart so that one gets sucked into the hole. With its partner having disappeared into the abyss of the hole, the other photon of the pair no longer has a partner with which to annihilate. Instead, Hawking showed that the remaining photon gets an energy boost from the gravitational force of the black hole and, as its partner falls inward, it gets shot outward, away from the black hole. Hawking realized that to someone looking at the black hole from the safety of afar, the combined effect of this tearing apart of virtual photon pairs, happening over and over again all around the horizon of the black hole, will appear as a steady stream of outgoing radiation. Black holes glow. Moreover, Hawking was able to calculate the temperature that a far-off observer would associate with the emitted radiation and found that it is given by the strength of the gravitational field at the black hole's horizon, exactly as the analogy between the laws of black hole physics and the laws of thermodynamics suggested. Bekenstein was right. Hawking's results showed that the analogy should be taken seriously. In fact, these results showed that it is much more than an analogy. It is an identity. A black hole has entropy. A black hole has temperature. And the gravitational laws of black hole physics are nothing but a rewriting of the laws of thermodynamics in an extremely exotic gravitational context. This was Hawking's 1974 bombshell. To give you a sense of the scales involved, it turns out that when one carefully accounts for all of the details, a black hole whose mass is about three times that of the Sun has a temperature of about 100 millionth of a degree above absolute zero. It's not zero, but only just. Black holes are not black, but only barely. Unfortunately, this makes a black hole's emitted radiation meager and impossible to detect experimentally. There is, however, an exception. Hawking's calculations showed that the less massive a black hole is, the higher its temperature and the greater the radiation it emits. For instance, a black hole as light as a small asteroid would emit about as much radiation as a 1,000,000 megaton hydrogen bomb, with radiation concentrated in the gamma ray part of the electromagnetic spectrum. Astronomers have searched the night sky for such radiation, but except for a few long-shot possibilities, they have come up empty-handed, a likely indication that such low-mass black holes, if they exist, are very rare. As Hawking often jokingly points out, this is too bad, for if the black hole radiation that his work predicts were to be detected, he would undoubtedly win a Nobel Prize. By contrast with its tiny sub-millionth of a degree temperature, when one calculates the entropy of, say, a 3-solar-mass black hole, the result is an absolutely enormous number, a 1 followed by about 78 zeros, and the more massive the hole, the greater the entropy. The success of Hawking's calculations unequivocally established that this truly reflects the enormous amount of disorder embodied by a black hole. But disorder of what? As we have seen, black holes appear to be terribly simple objects, so what is the source of this overwhelming disorder? On this question, Hawking's calculations were completely silent. His partial merger of general relativity and quantum mechanics could be used to find the numerical value of a black hole's entropy, but offered no insight into its microscopic meaning. For nearly a quarter of a century, some of the greatest physicists tried to understand what possible microscopic properties of black holes could account for their entropy, but without a fully trustworthy amalgam of quantum mechanics and general relativity, glimpses of an answer may have been uncovered, but the mystery remained unsolved. Enter string theory. Or it did, until January 1996, when Strominger and Waffe, building on earlier insights of Susskind and Sen, released a paper to the Electronic Physics Archive entitled Microscopic Origin of the Bekenstein-Hawking Entropy. In this work, Strominger and Waffe were able to use string theory to identify the microscopic constituents of a certain class of black holes and to calculate precisely their associated entropy. Their work relied on the newfound ability to partially circumvent the perturbative approximations in use during the 1980s and early 1990s, and the result they found agreed exactly with that predicted by Bekenstein and Hawking, finally completing a picture partially painted more than two decades previously. Strominger and Waffe focused on the class of so-called extremal black holes. These are black holes that are imbued with charge. You can think of it as electric charge, and that, moreover, have the minimal possible mass consistent with the charge they carry. As can be seen from this definition, they are closely related to the BPS states discussed in Chapter 12. In fact, Strominger and Waffe exploited this similarity to the hilt. They showed that they could build, theoretically of course, certain extremal black holes by starting with a particular collection of BPS brains of certain specified dimensions, and binding them together according to a precise mathematical blueprint. In much the same way that an atom can be built, theoretically, again, by starting with a bunch of quarks and electrons, and then precisely arranging them into protons and neutrons, surrounded by orbiting electrons, Strominger and Waffe showed how some of the newfound ingredients in string theory could similarly be molded together to yield particular black holes. In actuality, black holes are one possible end product of stellar evolution. After a star has burned all its nuclear fuel through billions of years of atomic fusion, it no longer has the strength, the outward-directed pressure, to withstand the enormous inward force of gravity. Under a broad spectrum of conditions, this results in a cataclysmic implosion of the star's enormous mass. It violently collapses under its own tremendous weight, forming a black hole. Contrary to this realistic means of formation, Strominger and Waffe advocated designer black holes. They turned the tables on black hole formation by showing how they could be systematically constructed, in a theorist's imagination, by carefully, slowly, and meticulously weaving together a precise combination of the brains that had emerged from the second superstring revolution. The power of this approach became immediately clear. By maintaining full theoretical control over the microscopic construction of their black holes, Strominger and Waffe could easily and directly count the number of rearrangements of the black hole's microscopic constituents that would leave its overall observable properties, its mass and force charges, unchanged. They could then compare this number with the area of the black hole's horizon, the entropy predicted by Bekenstein and Hawking. When Strominger and Waffe did so, they found perfect agreement. At least for the class of extremal black holes, they had succeeded in using string theory to account for the microscopic constituents and the associated entropy precisely. A quarter-century-old puzzle had been solved. Many string theorists view this success as an important and convincing piece of evidence in support of the theory. Our understanding of string theory is still too coarse to be able to make direct and precise contact with experimental observations of, say, the mass of a quark or an electron. But we now see that string theory has provided the first fundamental explanation of a long-established property of black holes that has stumped physicists using more conventional theories for many years. And this property of black holes is intimately tied up with Hawking's prediction that they should radiate, a prediction that, in principle, should be experimentally measurable. Of course, this requires that we definitively find a black hole in the heavens and then construct equipment sensitive enough to detect the radiation that it emits. If the black hole were light enough, the latter step is well within the reach of current technology. Even though this experimental program has not as yet met with success, it does re-emphasize that the chasm between string theory and definitive physical statements about the natural world can be bridged. Even Sheldon Glashow, the arch-rival of string theory through the 1980s, has said recently, "When string theorists talk about black holes, they are almost talking about observable phenomena, and that is impressive." The remaining mysteries of black holes. Even with these impressive developments, there are still two central mysteries surrounding black holes. The first concerns the impact black holes have on the concept of determinism. In the beginning of the 19th century, the French mathematician Pierre-Simon de Laplace enunciated the strictest and most far-reaching consequence of the clockwork universe that followed from Newton's laws of motion. "An intelligence that, at a given instant, could comprehend all the forces by which nature is animated and the respective situation of the beings that make it up, if, moreover, it were vast enough to submit these data to analysis, would encompass in the same formula the movements of the greatest bodies of the universe and those of the lightest atoms. For such an intelligence, nothing would be uncertain, and the future, like the past, would be open to its eyes." In other words, if at some instant you know the positions and velocities of every particle in the universe, you can use Newton's laws of motion to determine, at least in principle, their positions and velocities at any other prior or future time. From this perspective, any and all occurrences, from the formation of the sun to the crucifixion of Christ, strictly follow from the precise positions and velocities of the particulate ingredients of the universe a moment after the Big Bang. This rigid, lockstep view of the unfolding of the universe raises all sorts of perplexing philosophical dilemmas surrounding the question of free will, but its import was substantially diminished by the discovery of quantum mechanics. We have seen that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle undercuts Laplacian determinism because we fundamentally cannot know the precise positions and velocities of the constituents of the universe. Instead, these classical properties are replaced by quantum wave functions, which tell us only the probability that any given particle is here or there, or that it has this or that velocity. The downfall of Laplace's vision, however, does not leave the concept of determinism in total ruins. Wave functions, the probability waves of quantum mechanics, evolve in time according to precise mathematical rules, such as the Schrödinger equation, or its more precise relativistic counterparts, such as the Dirac equation and the Klein-Gordon equation. This informs us that quantum determinism replaces Laplace's classical determinism. Knowledge of the wave functions of all of the fundamental ingredients of the universe at some moment in time allows a vast enough intelligence to determine the wave functions at any prior or future time. Quantum determinism tells us that the probability that any particular event will occur at some chosen time in the future is fully determined by knowledge of the wave functions at any prior time. The probabilistic aspect of quantum mechanics significantly softens Laplacian determinism by shifting inevitability from outcomes to outcome likelihoods, but the latter are fully determined within the conventional framework of quantum theory. In 1976, Hawking declared that even this softer form of determinism is violated by the presence of black holes. Once again, the calculations behind this declaration are formidable, but the essential idea is fairly straightforward. When anything falls into a black hole, its wave function gets sucked in as well. But this means that in the quest to work out wave functions at all future times, our vast enough intelligence will be irreparably shortchanged. To predict the future fully, we need to know all wave functions fully today. But if some have escaped down the abyss of black holes, the information they contain is lost. At first sight, this complication arising from black holes may not seem worth worrying about, since everything behind the event horizon of a black hole is cut off from the rest of the universe. Can't we just completely ignore anything that is unfortunate enough to have fallen in? Philosophically, moreover, can't we tell ourselves that the universe has not really lost the information carried by the stuff that has fallen into the black hole? It is simply locked within a region of space that we rational beings choose to avoid at all costs? Prior to Hawking's realization that black holes are not completely black, the answer to these questions was yes. But once Hawking informed the world that black holes radiate, the story changed. Radiation carries energy, and so, as a black hole radiates, its mass slowly decreases, it slowly evaporates. As it does so, the distance from the center of the hole to the event horizon slowly shrinks, and as this shroud recedes, regions of space that were previously cut off re-enter the cosmic arena. Now our philosophical musings must face the music. Does the information contained in the things swallowed by the black hole, the data we imagined existing within the black hole's interior, re-emerge as the black hole evaporates? This is the information required for quantum determinism to hold, and so this question goes to the heart of whether black holes imbue the evolution of our universe with an even deeper element of happenstance. As of this writing, there is no consensus among physicists regarding the answer to this question. For many years, Hawking has strongly claimed that the information does not re-emerge, that black holes destroy information, thereby introducing a new level of uncertainty into physics, over and above the usual uncertainty associated with quantum theory. In fact, Hawking, together with Kip Thorne of the California Institute of Technology, has a bet with John Preskill, also of the California Institute of Technology, regarding what happens to the information captured by a black hole. Hawking and Thorne bet that the information is forever lost, while Preskill has taken the opposite position and bet that the information reemerges as the black hole radiates and shrinks. The wager? Information itself. The loser, or losers, will reward the winner, or winners, with an encyclopedia of the winner's choice. The bet remains unsettled, but Hawking has recently acknowledged that the newfound understanding of black holes from string theory, as discussed above, shows that there might be a way for the information to reemerge. The new idea is that for the kind of black holes studied by Strominger and Vaffa, and by many other physicists since their initial paper, information can be stored and recovered from the constituent brains. This insight, Strominger recently said, has led some string theorists to want to claim victory, to claim that the information is recovered as black holes evaporate. In my opinion, this conclusion is premature. There is still much work to be done in order to see if this is true. Vaffa concurs, saying that he is agnostic on this question. It could still turn out either way. Answering this question is a central goal of current research. As Hawking has put it, most physicists want to believe that information is not lost, as this would make the world safe and predictable. But I believe that if one takes Einstein's general relativity seriously, one must allow for the possibility that space-time ties itself in knots and that information gets lost in the folds. Determining whether or not information actually does get lost is one of the major questions in theoretical physics today. The second unresolved black hole mystery concerns the nature of space-time at the central point of the hole. A straightforward application of general relativity, going all the way back to Schwarzschild in 1916, shows that the enormous mass and energy crushed together at the black hole's center causes the fabric of space-time to suffer a devastating rift, to be radically warped into a state of infinite curvature, to be punctured by a space-time singularity. One conclusion that physicists drew from this is that since all of the matter that has crossed the event horizon is inexorably drawn to the center of the black hole, and since once there the matter has no future, time itself comes to an end at the heart of a black hole. Other physicists, who over the years have explored the properties of the black hole's core using Einstein's equations, revealed the wild possibility that it might be a gateway to another universe that tenuously attaches to ours only at a black hole's center. Roughly speaking, where time in our universe comes to an end, time in the attached universe just begins. We will take up some of the implications of this mind-boggling possibility in the next chapter. But for now, we want to stress one important point. We must recall the central lesson. Extremes of huge mass and small size leading to unimaginably large density invalidate the sole use of Einstein's classical theory and require that quantum mechanics be brought to bear as well. This leads us to ask, what does string theory have to say about the space-time singularity at the center of a black hole? This is a topic of intense current research, but as with the question of information loss, it has not yet been settled. String theory deftly deals with a variety of other singularities, the rips and tears in space discussed in Chapter 11 and in the first part of this chapter. But if you have seen one singularity, you have not seen them all. The fabric of our universe can be ripped, punctured, and torn in many different ways. String theory has given us profound insights into some of these singularities, but others, the black hole singularity among them, have so far eluded the string theorist's reach. The essential reason for this, once again, is the reliance on perturbative tools in string theory whose approximations, in this case, cloud our ability to analyze reliably and fully what happens at the deep interior point of a black hole. However, given the recent tremendous progress in non-perturbative methods and their successful applications to other aspects of black holes, string theorists have high hopes that it won't be long before the mysteries residing at the center of black holes start to unravel. Chapter 14. Reflections on Cosmology. Humans throughout history have had a passionate drive to understand the origin of the universe. There is, perhaps, no single question that so transcends cultural and temporal divides, inspiring the imagination of our ancient forebears as well as the research of the modern cosmologist. At a deep level, there is a collective longing for an explanation of why there is a universe, how it has come to take the form we witness, and for the rationale, the principle, that drives its evolution. The astounding thing is that humanity has now come to a point where a framework is emerging for answering some of these questions scientifically. The currently accepted scientific theory of creation declares that the universe experienced the most extreme of conditions, enormous energy, temperature, and density during its earliest moments. These conditions, as is by now familiar, require that both quantum mechanics and gravity be taken into account. And hence, the birth of the universe provides a profound arena for exercising the insights of superstring theory. We will discuss these nascent insights shortly, but first, we briefly recount the pre-string theory cosmological story, which is often referred to as the standard model of cosmology. The standard model of cosmology. The modern theory of cosmic origins dates from the decade and a half after Einstein's completion of general relativity. although Einstein refused to take his own theory at face value and accept that it implies that the universe is neither eternal nor static, Alexander Friedman did. And as we discussed in Chapter 3, Friedman found what is now known as the Big Bang solution to Einstein's equations, a solution that declares that the universe violently emerged from a state of infinite compression and is currently in the expanding aftermath of that primeval explosion. So certain was Einstein that such time-varying solutions were not a result of his theory that he published a short article claiming to have found a fatal flaw in Friedman's work. Some 8 months later, however, Friedman succeeded in convincing Einstein that there was, in fact, no flaw. Einstein publicly but curtly retracted his objection. Nevertheless, it is clear that Einstein did not think Friedman's results had any relevance to the universe. But about 5 years later, Hubble's detailed observations of a few dozen galaxies with the 100-inch telescope at Mount Wilson Observatory confirmed that, indeed, the universe is expanding. Friedman's work, refashioned in a more systematic and efficient form by the physicists Howard Robertson and Arthur Walker, still formed the foundation of modern cosmology.